Hello, all there out in the great wide internet, all of our beloved listeners. This is Beaches, and I'm here with Tea Prophet.
Greetings.
So we're going to talk about a bunch of stuff. So the first thing is you've been writing, you've been a part of the scene for a really long time, right? That's fair to say?
Yeah, I guess it's fair to say that I'm old.
No, I wouldn't say that.
I've been writing for 2600 since I was in high school, which, believe it or not, is 1992. Was my first article. And I am currently writing a column in every issue called The Telecom Informer, which you'll find on page 13.
Well, that's pretty exciting. I have my copy upstairs, so I'll have to definitely check that out. Okay, so you've been to every Hope, except for the first one, correct?
That's right. I couldn't afford the first one and DEF CON as well. And I have basically a pretty long history with DEF CON as well, having been to all of those. But I was here from the second Hope all the way through to now.
So I'm sure, as everybody knows, this is the 30th anniversary. So 30th year of the Hacker Quarterly, 2600, the Hacker Quarterly. This is the 20th year. The first Hope conference was in 1994, so this is 2014, so it's the 20th year of that, and this is the 10th Hope, which is all very exciting, a lot of very nice numbers.
That's some terrific numerology.
I know, isn't it great?
It's like, where's Wozniak? He loves that kind of stuff.
As you've seen pretty much over the entire lifespan of the conference, have you been happy with the direction that it's been going? Has it been more exciting every year?
So with Hope in particular, it has changed a lot because the scene's changed a lot. It's way more makery than it used to be. But I think that's a great direction. And one thing that I think the last three Hopes has been really interesting is the classic computer scene. There are a lot of people on the East Coast. You know, it's really, I do both Hope and DEF CON. And it's really interesting to see on the East Coast how the hacker community differs in a pretty substantial way from the West Coast scene. The West Coast scene's kind of, for better or worse, Silicon Valley focused, and so there's a lot of like Silicon Valley, Seattle, Los Angeles, West Coast kind of tech people. And the East Coast scene for hackers is more down to the roots. It's a really more authentic nerdiness that I really like at Hope. There isn't the frat boy kind of drinking scene here at all that you have on the West Coast. So, that's not a bad thing. Like, DEF CON's a great party. It's just different.
Well, that's to be expected. Just because, you have different people from different cultures, and that's just kind of how that works.
Well, yeah, and speaking of different cultures, one thing that I think is really awesome at Hope is we have so many people from Europe, because there's a lot of cheap flights from European cities, and so you'll meet a ton of Europeans here in New York that just can't make it to Las Vegas, either for time or cost reasons.
Yeah, it's great, actually. The diversity here is fantastic. You'll just see, it feels like there's people from all over the United States, all over the world, really, and it's fantastic. That's one of my favorite parts.
For sure. It's the scene is, the hacker scene in general is really diverse, and I think that it also is in at DEF CON in Las Vegas and other hacker gatherings. The thing that's really I think makes it very exciting is that New York's a really vibrant city. And it's very easy to get to from almost anywhere. So I think that even to a greater degree than other conferences, you have a more international voice. But getting back to your first question about what's different now versus 20 years ago, I think here and now is a really critical time for us as hackers, because actually, a lot of the stuff that we've been taking apart, it turns out the government's been doing exactly the same thing pretty much all along. And so, here I am 2 years after giving a talk that was pretty roundly criticized. It was an obscure topic on what some of the surveillance capability of the telecommunication switches that were found in Tunisia and in Libya after both of those governments collapsed. I got roundly criticized after giving that talk. When I inferred that maybe, just maybe, that functionality could possibly be being abused in the U.S. And many people told me, that's impossible. You know, the laws are very clear on what the government can do and what it can't do. And here we are, you know, 2 years later with Edward Snowden telling us more about the reality of what's been going on. So it's a really different mood, because actually a lot of people here are thinking not about taking stuff apart so much anymore. It's more like, how do we put it back together? How do we put back a society where actually it is possible to make a mistake and not have a permanent record? And how is it possible to build a society where actually people in society know what the government that they've elected to do is doing in their name?
Those are really great points, actually. I remember when the leaks first started, I definitely felt like, wow, I feel like I'm a conspiracy nut now, because all of those things that you would have said, you know, just the day before, people be like, nah, that would never happen. And I think it's definitely great, the response that we've been getting, definitely like putting it back together. It's like, okay, so obviously the stuff that we have now is flawed, so how do we put it back together in such a way that it still does mostly the same thing, but in a way that isn't gonna, you know, follow people around and you know, be harmful.
Yeah, and so two hopes ago, which mm-hmm. would have been 4 years ago, or maybe three hopes ago, 6 years ago, I forget which, mm-hmm. I gave a talk called Own Your Phone. And what that kind of turned into, you know, it was the beginning of the smartphone revolution.
Right.
And I asked a question that I think is still a very good one at the time, which was, wow, we've invented this like really incredible technology. Smartphones are really useful. They can do some amazing things. And yet, we're not really thinking as hackers about what the privacy and the social implications are of this technology that we've invented. And, you know, here I am, I guess it's 4 to 6 years later. I think it's 6 years later, mm-hmm. Because we just had the first iPhone when I gave the Own Your Phone talk. So that must have been 6 years
yeah,
ago.
Yeah, 6 years.
And one of the first things that I saw when I came to New York is all these people walking around with Google Glass. And, you know, so everything old is new again. We're again, asking the same question. And I actually feel very passionately about this. How do people behave in a world where everything and everyone around them is potentially being recorded? Do you self-censor? Do you have the conversations that you would have if that weren't happening? And that actually worries me a lot. I think that, you know, we're in a really unusual time in the history of our country, but we're also at a crossroads when it comes to how humans use technology. Because actually, I think that technology to some degree has jumped the shark. We have, you know, just because it's kind of like science in the 50s, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just because you could do something, it suddenly became a good idea, and radiation was being released in the atmosphere in the Pacific Northwest, where I'm from, just to find out what would happen downwind. That actually happened. And here we are with all data being collected in a facility in Utah, downwind, incidentally, of the Pacific Northwest. So maybe the one has something to do with the other, and we're doing it not for any particular reason necessarily, or because it's a good idea, just because we can. This is worrisome. I think it's a frightening trend, and maybe it's time to think a little more carefully about which things that we as technologists are allowing the government and our employers to do.
I think that's a really good point. You're giving a talk, because we've just come talking about one of your old talks. So you're giving a talk this time to, you're doing one tomorrow, correct?
Yeah, and I'm totally shifting gears from what I've spoken about before, because, you know, I've given a few talks largely around the subject of surveillance and the technology that enables that. You know, there's nothing I'm going to say to add to the conversation at this point beyond what Edward Snowden has already told us. It actually is so much worse than we thought. And so when I got to thinking about what I could speak about, I pulled out something that I'm actually have been working on for close to a year now. It's called Seat 31B. And I have a passion for travel. If you read the Telecom Informer column, you'll see that I write about telecommunications all over the world. And I do travel in large part just to see how people use phones and technology and the internet. And a lot of that will be, you know, is in every issue in my column. I've been everywhere from Palau to Ecuador writing about phone systems in these places. So along the way, I've learned a lot of tricks. And You might wonder, like, if I'm independently wealthy to be able to travel like this. You know, the answer is no, I'm really not. I'm just willing to sit in seat 31B, which is that middle seat in the back of the plane nobody wants. But I'm happy to have it because it was free or really cheap.
I've definitely sat in that seat myself. So you're doing a lot of traveling. What would you say are some of the most interesting places that you've gotten the chance to travel to?
Well, I've gotten to travel to all seven continents, which I feel really lucky and blessed to have been able to do. Probably the two most interesting places that I've been are, just because they're so hard to get to, are North Korea and Antarctica.
Wow, those are some very impressive places. I'm trying to think if we should ask about Antarctica first or North Korea.
Pick one.
Let's go with Antarctica first, because I feel like North Korea is probably going to be more interesting, so, you know, end on a high note.
Yeah, for sure. Well, North Korea is actually a surprisingly boring place to visit. Antarctica is way more interesting.
Oh, is it? Okay.
So the way you get there, you know, there's actually two ways. You can either pay a ridiculous amount of money and go in a boat, which is what I did, or you can join your country's Antarctic program. The U.S. has a big one. And then you go to work. In order to get there, I flew from Seattle to Ushuaia, Argentina.
Oh, wow.
And I did that for free since I managed to use my frequent flyer miles to do it. Believe it or not, it's possible. From there, I went with World Tour, it's a group of people also involved in Tour Camp, which just happened in the Pacific Northwest. And also, I don't know if you've heard of TourCon, but it's a small hacker conference in San Diego and Seattle.
Oh, wow.
And the organizers of these cons organized a trip to Antarctica. So I got to go with them, and it actually got the price down quite a lot because we did it as a group.
Yeah, doing stuff in groups is fantastic when group discounts are great.
Well, and also the group of people, because it was a group of hackers.
You know,
what's cooler than to go to Antarctica with a group of hackers who brought a 3D printer with them? Like, we did the first manufacturing of anything in Antarctica that's ever happened, evidently. And it was all done on a 3D printer.
What'd you guys manufacture?
Around 1-inch high toy penguins, or penguin figurines. They were auctioned off on the boat for a charity which the cruise line operates.
Okay, that sounds awesome. Is there anything else? Like, what was your favorite part about Antarctica, other than being with a group of hackers doing some very exciting and wonderful things?
Well, of course, it's Antarctica, right? So hardly anybody goes there. It's one of the most remote places in the world, although there's surprisingly more habitation than I expected. You know, there's a lot of research stations and bases, and there's even, like, navigational aids in the waters there. So it doesn't look, you think of this place as a frozen continent where there's no human activity, but actually, the little arm that juts up towards South America has a lot of people there every summer. And it's the austral summer, of course, which is like the opposite of ours. What did we get to see? A lot of seals, a lot of wildlife, skua gulls, and of course penguins. You know, there are so many different ones. If you're a fan of Linux, there are in fact Gen 2 penguins there, and their poop really stinks. That's the worst. that's something we totally didn't expect, is like what the smells and the sounds of Antarctica would be. So it turns out penguins are really loud. They make this like extremely loud honking kind of noise. And they poop everywhere, and it really, really stinks. It smells like like rotting fish and poop.
That sounds disgusting.
Yeah, but it's like disgusting, but it's also so incredibly awesome.
It sounds actually really amazing. So let's talk shift gears a little bit, and let's talk about your time in North Korea.
Sure. I was part of the first group of Americans to visit North Korea. I tried to go in 2004. And, basically, like, getting in there at the time involved going with some shady English guy who had a relationship with the North Koreans for whatever reason. And, there was, like, some certain amount of money that would be paid and, like, a visa would be issued. And so, like, I booked tickets to China just on the speculation that this might happen. Mm-hmm. And so did another guy named Peter that I met over there. And basically we got there and it turned out that, something political had happened and like the visas just weren't going to happen. So like we were in Beijing and, planning to take Air Koryo, which is the like North Korean airline and fly down to Pyongyang, and basically it totally didn't happen. So I got an email in 2005, you know, a year later, which is like, hey, if you can be in Beijing in the next week, there's a pretty good chance we can get you in. And so again, I got on a plane and flew to Beijing, and it did in fact happen that time. And, you know, so I joined the first group of Americans who were able to enter North Korea as tourists.
Wow, that's actually really amazing.
Well, it's, you know, you would think it's amazing, but it's not. It's a grand tour of monuments. They take you to the their replica of the Arc de Triomphe, which is, of course, bigger than the real Arc de Triomphe. Then they take you in what they call the world's deepest subway. Their president actually is dead. It's Kim Il-sung. But when Saddam Hussein declared himself president for life, he declared himself eternal president. You know, just to, so you can see that with North Korea, there's this theme, right? Like, you know, they have to be bigger or deeper or, like, you know, more longevity or whatever than anyone else. And I will also point out that in a study of penis size that was done, Koreans on average have the smallest penises in the world. So, you know, I'm not sure if the one has anything to do with the other, but there you are.
Okay, so you're going to be talking tomorrow about your travel hints, about how to see the world. Are you mostly focusing on having the best time possible or doing it the cheapest way possible, or is it some combination of the two?
Well, you know, the best time possible is really up to you, because travel is a very individual thing. I mean, you know, a great idea of something fun to do to me is to go on tour around Armenia. And, you know, it wasn't so fun to run into a cow or get arrested there, but, you know, both of them make good stories. And I'll be talking a little bit about, you know, some of these kinds of destinations tomorrow in my talk. But I've developed some techniques over time that actually do get me to some really amazing places, and I've been able to do it for cheap or actually nearly free. For example, I'm taking a round-the-world trip in November, and the price that I paid is like paying only $219. Round trip, like, you know, all the way around the world, leaving from Los Angeles to Boston to Rome to Budapest to Amsterdam to Beijing, the Hong Kong, LA, and then Seattle for Christmas. And, you know, basically the whole thing combined, you know, is basically like less than you'd pay for a round trip from almost anywhere on the East Coast to New York. It's entirely possible to do this. So, you know, when people come to me and they say, oh, I'd love to travel like you do, but I totally can't afford it, my answer to that is, you know, actually, it doesn't take a lot of money anymore. You just have to think like a hacker.
Wow, that is really impressive. We're going to need to probably get going here soon. So is there anything that you really want to talk about that you won't have a chance to talk about during your time tomorrow?
I have an hour tomorrow, so hopefully I'll be able to cover a lot. But if I can leave people on the internet and on the radio with any thought who aren't actually able to travel, or have thought that they aren't able to travel, it's just apply your hacker ingenuity to any travel wishes that you have, and actually it's possible. And to get you started, I have a great website. I'd love for you to take a look at it. It's SEAT, SEAT31B.com, and you'll find tons of tricks and tips and travel information out there. And, you know, mine isn't the only blog, but actually what I cover is thinking about travel like a hacker. So I hope that you'll have a look, and I would love to see everyone tomorrow.
Okay, that sounds fantastic. It was great having you on. We're going to take a quick, brief little wait, and then we're going to be on with Radio Wonderland. We'll be back in just a little bit.